Welcome to Your Cases on Hold, a JBJS podcast hosted by Antonia Chen and Andrew Schoenfeld.
Here, we discuss the science of each issue of JBJS with an additional dose of entertainment and pop culture.
Take us with you in the gym, on the commute, or most certainly, whenever your case is on hold. Welcome back, everyone, to Your Cases on Hold, episode 91. As we begin the journey to episode 100, this is the episode one on the path to 100, the next 10 episodes of Your Case on Hold. If you're listening on the day we drop, it's September 30th for the October 1st issue of JBJS. I, as always, am Andrew Schoenfeld, associate editor for Methods, and I have with me
Antonia Chen, executive editor at JBJS.
For a limited time only. As always, these opinions, the takes, probably get hotter as we go to episode 100.
They are like hotcakes. Hot.
There we go. My opinions, the opinions of Dr. Chen, not those of the editor-in-chief of JBJS or the other constituent journals in the JBJS family of publications, should not be taken as the opinions of the executive board, the board of trustees. This episode of JBJS is brought to you by JBJS CME and Clinical Classroom. So check that out if you're not already subscribing and getting credit for everything you do in association with the journal to begin with. If you haven't already, please like and subscribe, share the podcast so that others can join the Your Cases on Hold family. Give us a 5-star rating. We're on Stitcher, Castos, Amazon, Apple, Spotify. Barring that, you can get it at the JBJS website or maybe on YouTube. There's some place that these videos get posted, but I don't even know where. And I hate looking at myself on video anyway, so I'm not interested in finding out. But so if anybody knows, you don't have to tell me. The only place I see it is at the Academy meeting. They always have like at the JBJS thing, we're in the background on a big screen.
Well, it's also even more awkward when they take a picture of you in front of that big screen with you on it.
Right, yes. Like a frozen and it's never flattering. Anyhow, so let's get into it. This is the top of the pile, the role of non-inferiority studies in orthopedic surgery, determining whether the outcomes are the same, no worse, or simply not different. That sounds like a riddle. This is by Burks. Then we have the presidential installation. I believe this is an AOA article, Institutional Trust and Leadership, or Lack Thereof. That's my own editorializing. This is by Dr. Ghanayam. Then we have Impact of Tourniquet Use on Arthroscopic Anterior Cruciate Ligament Reconstruction, Systematic Review and Meta-Analysis of Randomized Controlled Trials by Mirgaderi et al. You will notice that that's it for top of the pile. We are starting to see that The issues of JBJS are shrinking some, and we're going to have our headlines, we're going to have our Your Case on Hold featurette, and then there's just a small handful of honorable mentions and a few on top of the pile. I think in the next issue, it's a little bit larger, but then I believe once we get into November, most of these issues will be the size that we're seeing here right now in episode 91. At least that's my understanding from the powers that be. We'll see what comes to pass in the end. Let's get into the headlines here. My headline is Predicting Anterior Cruciate Ligament Reconstruction Revision Risk, an Enhanced Machine Learning Analysis of the Danish Knee Ligament Reconstruction Registry by Anderson and colleagues. This comes with a comment and an infographic. I like stuff from Denmark. You ever have the Danish cookies at Christmas? Danish
yes. butter cookies? Love those things.
Yes, those go down way too easy.
But I think it's the sugar crumb crisps on top that really. Yeah,
my favorite is the pretzel.
Oh, the pretzel one's my favorite too because it's got maximum surface area with the sugar crystals on it. So
nice, nice. Send us some butter cookies, guys.
We're on board for it, guys.
there are no butter cookies in the ACL area, unfortunately. Yeah. So this is a study that analyzed surgical and patient-reported outcome measure from almost 19,000 patients, over 18,500 patients in the Danish registry who underwent ACL between 2005 and 2023. It's a machine learning study. Obviously, the idea behind machine learning is that when you have large data samples such as this, you can, or the machine can rather, identify patterns and see predictions in areas that you can't with the naked human eye. That's the advertising behind machine learning, is it's the power of the computer to make all sorts of comparisons over and over and over again, looking for patterns. You know, it's like the Terminator eye with like all the information running in the background. But basically, it's going to tell you stuff that you didn't even know about. It's going to show you things that you could not perceive yourself without the power of the machine and AI and all of these innovations behind it. I think, you know, at the end of the day, as we've presented many machine learning papers over the course of our 90 episodes thus far, and your case is on hold. And it really comes down to, one, how big is the sample that you're working off of? Two, what's your approach to machine learning? And then three, you know, what's produced a new paradigm, this real epiphany of, wow, you know, I never would have thought of that before, and I wouldn't have known it. Or does it end up, you know, is it like this really momentous, you're at the top of Mount Everest and the view is just breathtaking? Or is it a Sopranos paradigm where you're just left with, really, that's it? You did all that, just all that buildup just for, you know, age and smoking is the situation here. Not that that's the answer for this, but I'm just saying, like, that's kind of where you are. You get like this huge build. The methods are always, you know, very rich. It looks like they're doing a lot of things. Is it they're really doing stuff, or is it a man behind the green curtain sort of paradigm where it's just a lot of show? And in this case, I think it's a little bit of both, honestly.
You mean like more than meets the eye, Transformer style?
Right, but it isn't Transformers. It's just somebody in a plastic suit.
Touche.
Right? That's the analogy.
True. Like, is it really a robot that
turns into a car, or is it just somebody dressed up in a costume like you get in Times Square and they're all creepy and fawny around and be like, you want to get your picture with Bumblebee? No, I don't want to get my picture with Bumblebee.
You get to give a tip if you do. Remember that.
They're like, it's $80. So yeah, that's what this is. This I think ends up being the dude in the Bumblebee costume who's a creeper in Times Square following you around harassing you to get a photo. Sneak preview.
It sounds like the idea of nightmares, but please go ahead.
Yeah. So, I mean, you know, they run all of these different models. They run all the standard models. They have the lasso and the stable iterative variable selection approach. And basically what they come up with is that they run a Cox regression analysis because that works the best. So you could have just done this by running a Cox regression analysis and you didn't have to do the whole machine learning bit behind it. That's all just preamble. At the end of the day, this is, they call it an ML Cox. It's a machine learning enhanced Cox analysis because essentially the machine learning piece helped select the final variables that were included in the Cox analysis. But this is really where I'm at, because it's the model is developed to calculate the risk at different follow-up time points beyond the 12-month post-operative assessment, which is cool. That part is cool. Because, you know, standard, you're just seeing people up to 12 months and then maybe you're stopping, right? So this is going to be telling people, look, at 12 months, these individuals with these characteristics, you need to keep watching them. Okay. And that part is cool. Then they give you the math equation. And anytime you're putting a math equation in like a clinical research journal, it definitely gets the dude and the Brandt paradigm where you're just saying, no, don't do that. Why are we giving the math equation here? Somebody's going to do it on the blackboard. You're like, go up and calculate the Danish knee score criteria during grand rounds here. Come up to the front and do the math. The 1 minus ST exponent to the negative 0.07. I mean, no one is going to do the calculation, right? And you don't need to do the calculation because Now it's the Dude and Brant paradigm times two. They, of course, have a handy dandy clinical utility that is available online for the risk monitoring tool. And again, no, don't say that. Don't say that. So don't give the math. And until your model is like super vetted, prospectively validated, analyzed in other clinical contexts with complete, until you have all of that, you shouldn't be making the tool available for clinical use, because that part is not validated. You just came up with the model. And the reality is that we know from most, and you've heard me say this before, but in most of these types of studies, these models don't hold up in other settings. They're very good at predicting within the context of these parameters, like how they operate in Denmark and nothing, you know, or how they operate in Norway. But these are countries that it's the size of like Boston, like population, or the greater Boston area, right? There are more people in New York City than live in some of these countries in total. And that's not anything, it's not casting aspersions or anything like that, but it's just when you're talking about a model that you're developing within a population that's already quite small, even though you can say, oh, we have 18,000 patients, right? But even among the 18,000 patients, is that spanning the complete spectrum of all possible iterations of patients with this condition in sufficient numbers when you consider how it may present in the United States context, or in the Chinese context, or in the Russian context, or the Indian context, or Southeast Asian context? No, it isn't. And the simple answer, it's a rhetorical question, it's not. And that's why they don't perform as well. And that is why you need more scientific work around developing these types of parameters and looking at these types of predictive models before you start making handy online calculation tools that people can use. To move on and not belabor that point, they found that the enhanced ML-Cox regression analysis that combined the Lasso and the SIVS approaches demonstrated good accuracy. Their C index was 0.73. Their end of the curve, C statistic is 0.73. I'd like to see it a little bit higher, honestly. And the ML-Cox regression model provide the best prediction accuracy while utilizing four variables: age at surgery and three individual CUS items, pain P1, quality of life Q2, and Q3. So the first thing is that this could be done if they just said, based on our conceptual model, we're going to go with age and these three CUS items and run it in a Cox regression analysis. At the end of the day, that's what this is. The machine learning model picked out these variables. They let the machine learning model decide on that, and that's fine. But I'm like, you have 18,000 patients, right? And out of all these parameters, you just picked four parameters. It just doesn't seem like the machine learning model should have.
It can take a lot.
Right. What did you eat for breakfast the day before the surgery? And all of these different things that are playing into the system, not just four fairly mundane characteristics that you could have come up with on your own, essentially. Like, so if I told you, you know, patients of a certain age, we'll just say in this context, you know, older patients who have higher pain and aren't doing well at 12 months after an ACL, do you think they're going to be more likely to need a revision surgery or not? Yeah, I think they're going to be more likely to need a revision surgery. And any kind of percent estimates that you're getting off of this model are going to be parochial by definition to this Danish cohort and not necessarily. So you could say, oh, if you have these, you know, there's a 20% risk, right? And in your setting, in your highly involved athlete who's playing football, American football, not soccer, in Texas, their revision risk could be 50%. And that's the other thing, is that, you know, they say it's a simple tool for identifying patients who are considered at an increased risk for ACLR revision beyond routine orthopedic follow-up. These patients may have already returned to pre-injury sporting or occupational activities, but their CUS values place them in a cohort with a predicted increased risk of future ACL revision. So this is also to some extent ignoring the intersection, an important intersection, I believe, in this context of how is the patient doing and how are they trying to return to their sport? So the person who's not doing well, but keeps trying to push to get back to their sport, they're probably going to need revision. The person who says, all right, you know what? I can't get back to my pre-injury activity level. I'm just accepting it at this point. Maybe they don't end up needing a revision. And that's a component that I think is missing here and isn't considered and isn't presented. And you know, the way they present it in the discussion, it's sort of clear that it's not a seminal component of the prediction model. And that's a piece that I think is vital, really. So I think it's a cool concept. I think it's a cool article. I think there's just a lot of issues around both the approach and what they ended up coming up with. And I have questions about how ultimately valid the predictions will be. So if you're trying to do the math or make the math, the math is not mathing. Make the math work, whatever Instagram meme you want to go with, and use this yourself, I would say be very cautious. Yeah, a lot of these end up like these prediction model validations. When they say, oh, it's validated, that really just means that your practice is similar to their practice and you have similar outcomes to them, which means you can use it. You certainly can use it, but it doesn't mean that it's going to be universally applicable to every sports medicine practice everywhere.
And remember, we started this by talking about Denmark. So right. That's also another big area, right?
Yeah.
So, yep.
It's probably good for Denmark. I mean, excellent. Denmark is probably the place I don't have questions about it being applied to.
Yeah.
Get those people back into their sporting activities. And they probably don't even eat the Danish cookies there.
They say they're dry. Not as tasty for them.
All right. Your headline, conversion of fused knees to total knee arthroplasty, the 21 to 31 year clinical results and patient satisfaction by Kim and colleagues. 30 days free with a visual summary. Take it away.
Talk about long-term follow-up. And this is real-world data, not necessarily just like AI learning and things like that, which I think is important. So knee fusions converted to total knee arthroplasty is not necessarily a very common procedure, but there's very limited long-term data on it. So this study looked at the long-term. And when they say long-term, they said minimum 21 years, which is pretty impressive. Minimum long-term typically means 10 years, I would say, but this is 21 years, results of total knee arthroplasty in a fused knee, looking at the following: clinical and radiographic results, revision rates, complication rates, TKA survivorship, and patient satisfaction. So they looked at patients from January 1993 to December 2005 and looked at 128 consecutive fused knees in 123 patients who were converted to total knee arthroplasty. And the indications for conversions were patients' dissatisfaction with their disability, inability to sit properly, inability to use public transportation, difficulty in climbing stairs, and low back pain due to gait alteration or limb length discrepancy. They excluded patients with active infection, foot and ankle disorders, dementia, or a history of stroke. Over the follow-up period, 7 knees were excluded because they declined to participate in the study. 6 knees died, and that's actually pretty impressive over 21 plus year history. 20 knees were lost to follow-up, and clinical and radiographic results and patient satisfaction were analyzed in the remaining 93 patients, which were 51 men and 42 women, and 95 knees. The range of follow-up, minimum 21, which we already knew, and it goes up to 31 years, and the mean follow-up time was 25.1 years. The mean age and standard deviation of the patients at the time of the index procedure was 42 years approximately. The range was 23 to 62. So it is a younger patient population than what we typically do for total knees. The mean weight was 59 kilograms, not BMI, kilograms. And the mean BMI was 24. So a different patient population than we typically have in the United States. As I said, that's to clarify, the mean weight was 59, truly weight, not BMI. So why did all these patients undergo knee fusions? The most common reason was childhood tuberculosis in 56% of the patients. There was childhood pyogenic arthritis in 34% of the patients and rheumatoid arthritis in 11% of the patients. The mean duration of fusion was approximately 20 years, range of 5 to 36 years. previous operations were performed in 83% of the knees. They did have arthrotomy for the knee joint to drain pus, was in 21% of the knees, twice in 7 knees and 3 times in 6 knees. So a lot of infection. And then finally just led to fusion, probably to reduce the likelihood of needing to undergo these treatments for infectious processes. And surgical orthodontics had been performed in 48%, and the remaining knees had undergone spontaneous fusions. So these weren't all surgical fusions. Some of these were spontaneous fusions. The mean position of the fused knees was 40 degrees of flexion. So this is what's interesting to me. So they had a range of 0 to 135 degrees of flexion. So to, I guess they spontaneously fused in 135. That's a really, really interesting way to ambulate. You talk about a fully, fully flexed leg all the way, and that's what their fusion was. A VY cost, so from a surgical perspective, when they underwent the conversion from the fusion to a total knee, a VY quadriceplasty was performed in 75% of patients to prevent patella tendon avulsion. The patella was osteotomized from the femoral condyles in almost 70% of patients. The two implants they used were from the same company. One was a semi-constrained, and that was done in 47% of patients, and then a PS, or posterior stabilized components, were used in 53% of patients. So they were able to use primary knee components in the slight majority of patients, but really it was almost 50-50 divided down the center. The semi-constrained knee components that were used in the 26% of knees, these patients were fused in greater than 75 degrees of flexion. So these type of patients, you probably do a huge amount of soft tissue releases, medial lateral collaterals, everything had to go. They didn't do hinges. I'm sorry. This is a semi-constraint. So they just wanted to release more. So they ended up using revision components, or as we'll talk about in a little bit, they also had bone loss. And so because of bone loss, they used femoral and tibial augments in about 52% of patients. So that helped maintain the joint line, et cetera. For those who had been fused in greater than 75 degrees of flexion, if they ended up in 45 degrees of flexion or more at the end of surgery, they used skeletal traction through a threaded Steinmann pin in the distal tibia to pull on the patient as opposed to further soft tissue releases or bone resection. So that's pretty impressive. I don't know if that would work as well in our country. I don't know if people would be okay with having skeletal traction for long periods of time, but they did that and it seemed to help with people's range of motion. They were followed up at 3 months, 1 year, and then every 5 years, they had Knee Society scores, WOMAC scores, and UCLA activity scores. At the outpatient final follow-up, patients got a 5-point Likert scale to look at their satisfaction and their ability to perform housework and yard work, ability to engage in recreational activity, and just their overall results. They graded their change in quality of life with one of 6 different responses: more than I ever dreamed possible, great improvement, moderate improvement, a little improvement, and no improvement. Or the quality of life of my life is worse than prior to surgery. So how do these patients do? So the mean Knee Society score started at 60 and went up to 88 postoperatively at the final follow-up. Very few had excellent Knee Society scores, only 5%. The majority, 69%, had good scores. 14% had fair scores and 12% had poor scores. The mean WOMAC score was approximately 68 points pre-op and 21 points post-op. The mean knee flexion at the final follow-up was 76.4 degrees with a range of 70 to 105. The mean extension lag was 13 degrees with a range between 8 to 21 degrees. Before the operation, 13% had been non-walkers, while 87% had been able to walk less or equal to 5 blocks, but no patients were able to walk more than 5 blocks. At the final follow-up, there were no patients that was a non-walker, so everyone was walking. 16% were able to walk less than or equal to 5 blocks, and 84% were able to walk greater than 5 blocks. So from a functional standpoint, that's pretty impressive by being able to walk more. Now, what it doesn't tease out is it, 6 blocks, 7 blocks, 8 blocks, we don't know, walk a marathon, that sort of stuff. We don't know the details of how much they can actually walk. The mean UCLA activity score was 5 points preoperatively and 6 points postoperatively at final follow-up. Knee alignment was pretty good at 3 to 6 degrees of valgus at the final follow-up. No knee had greater than 5 millimeter of instability on manual stress testing, probably because they were incredibly stiff. And radiographs had no visible radiolucency at the bone cement or cement implant interface in 91% of the knees. With regards to revisions, 9% underwent revision for aseptic loosening. One knee was revised for infection, and another knee was revised for recurrent tuberculosis infection. The overall patient satisfaction score at the final follow-up was 77 points. Satisfaction regarding pain relief, housework, recreational activities, and surgical results were approximately 80%. Approximately 20% were neutral or dissatisfied. 67% of patients said their quality of life improved greatly after surgery, but approximately 10% said their quality of life was actually worse. Kaplan-Meier survivorship with failure as an endpoint, or vision for failure as an endpoint, was 88.4% at 25.1 years postoperatively. This is a huge series of fused knees. I haven't seen that many fused knees in my own career, so to have such a collection of them over that period of time with 25-year follow-up is pretty impressive. They might see more pyogenic arthritis than we do, more spontaneous fusions. I don't know what the Korean population is, but that is where this study was done. But it was surprising to see that many patients being converted to total knee arthroplasty. Again, it's a different patient population for the United States, but it gives us some tips and tricks. There are some surgical tips and tricks in here, but it is interesting data. And I do respect that it is a long follow-up study and gives some outcomes of this difficult patient population.
Yeah, no, you got to respect the follow-up for sure. I mean, that's a tremendous amount of time to keep track of these patients and have them come in for these, you know, functional evaluations. It is a rote clinical retrospective of this group's experience. I would have liked to have seen 95% confidence intervals just developed around the, you know, it's small number of event rates. It's not that large. I mean, it's large for the problem, but it's not that large when you just consider the total numbers, and having some 95% confidence intervals developed around, you know, the estimates regarding how many required revision or when it recurrent infection or et cetera would have been nice. But all in all, you got to respect the follow-up there. All right, moving into the Your Cases on Hold featurette. Efficacy and safety of tranexamic acid combined with absorbable hemostat in reducing perioperative blood loss in total knee arthroplasty, a prospective blinded randomized controlled trial by Zhang and colleagues. It's with a comment, infographic, 30 days free. You hit the perfecta on this one. What's your TXA admin preference? Is it IV pre-op and then before closing?
Yes.
That's the standard, right? That's the standard.
That is the standard. It's easier from a perspective. Oral used to be a lot cheaper, but you'd administered that sometime before surgery. So for our missions trip, we will take oral tranexamic acid, actually. Mm-hmm. Which is pretty nice. And then topical for those patients who really can't tolerate it orally.
Right. So this is a randomized trial that had three arms. This study included tranexamic acid and then in combination or separately with absorbable hemostat, which is a hemostatic agent that, unlike the antifibrinolytic mechanism of TXA, the absorbable hemostat exerts a local hemostatic effect through physical and chemical pathways. Upon contact with blood, this agent causes erythrocyte destruction, exposing hemoglobin. The carboxyl groups in the hemostat further oxidize hemoglobin to hematin, releasing ferric ions, accelerate platelet aggregation, adhesion, leading to the formation of a hemostatic thrombus. Additionally, by providing a scaffold for platelet adhesion and aggregation and enabling the formation of a gelatinous mass through its water-absorbing property, the hemostat effectively controls bleeding from capillaries, venules, and arterioles. This is all language that's directly contained in the paper. I just, for me and spine, it's, you know, basically thrombin and gel foam. Like, that's the equivalent that comes to mind. The hemostat can also be used as a scaffold to absorb TXA, they say, preventing local loss. So the way this study was done, all surgeries were performed by the same surgeon using a standard anterior midline incision. A tourniquet was applied for 10 minutes at the time of skin incision and then during cementation. In the TXA group, TXA alone, 1 gram of TXA was applied locally within the joint cavity. In the hemostat alone group, they had a sheet that was positioned posterior, inferior, medial, and superior to the joint capsule. And then in the combined group, they basically did both things together. And the results show there was a significant reduction in perioperative blood loss in the combined cohort, which did the best, probably not surprisingly. The worst was TXA alone. And then in between the two was the hemostat alone. Regarding safety, the combination of the two did not increase risk of DVT and or PE, which is great. But a couple of thoughts here. So the first thing that really struck me, and love for you to weigh in here, is the blood loss. Now, again, I immediately went to look at the surgical technique when I saw the blood loss in the abstract. And I was like, how are they doing the surgery? You know, what's the deal with the tourniquet? They only had the tourniquet up at certain small amounts of time, because in the TXA alone group, the blood loss was basically 879 cc's. That just seems a lot. you're getting close to like a liter there.
So this is the hardest part about blood loss, right? Whenever you ask a surgeon how much blood loss they had, they're like minimal, you know what I mean? Or like 100 cc, right? There will be minimal blood loss. The patient has a condition called asystole. I have not heard it before. Yeah. And so, but the hidden blood loss, I think, is an interesting one that people don't take into account. So I think we lose a lot more blood than we realize. Is it a liter every time? I don't know. But it is one of those things where it can actually be a good amount of blood, surprisingly enough.
Now, you know, they had all these other parameters, which I think I'm focused on the clinical aspects, but they did all these other things where there's kind of like a basic science component to this too. Mm-hmm. They had in vitro dynamic coagulation assays, LDH activity measurements, scanning EM. They used a in vivo rabbit liver bleeding model to assess these, you know, different parameters. And that's all well and good, but the RCT part is what we're really focused on here. And that's the part where we're, you know, some of this is proof of concept. What we're talking about is translational capacity and generalizability. I think that the single surgeon, this is the thing, like the single surgeon, good and bad, right? Because the single surgeon, there's no blinding here. The surgeon has to know what they're doing. You have to tell them, like, you're going to do the TXA or you're going to do the... And if the surgeon knows what they're doing, they could swing it a certain way. Like, they could do some things to try to reduce the blood loss. It's just one person. So they're doing a randomized trial. You want that randomized trial to have results that are reportable, right? And if they all do the same, it's probably not going to be publishable, right? So is there some implicit potential for bias there? I think there could be. And I just have some concern. I get what you're saying about the hidden blood loss, but I just have some concern with the face validity on the EBL for the two TXA, which I think is really so well established as far as its efficacy in reducing blood loss. If the TXA and the hemostat group together, like just those two alone, if they had comparable blood loss, I'd say fine, but they don't. The TXA was 879, the hemostat was 693. So I just think that those numbers are a little bit suspect to me. I think there's some, the face validity there, I think you're kind of getting called into question.
Doesn't pass the sniff test is what you would expect from blood loss.
Right? I'd expect what I'm, you know, just thinking of as like applying thrombin and gel foam or putting TXA around, like they should basically be doing the same, right? Otherwise, why are we even using TXA? We should just be doing the thrombin and gel foam. Now, again, that brings us back to the question I posed to you at the beginning, where this is not the ideal approach for TXA, I think. I think the standard is the IV pre-op and then prior to closure, right?
I think most people use that for sure.
Yeah. So this is not an apples to apples comparison. And obviously, if you're going to use two hemostatic agents, why wouldn't we expect that those are going to probably perform better than if you're just using one alone, right?
Exactly. More better. More,
right. More is definitely better. But right. Is the cost justified?
Right. And that's where it says money and dollar bills.
Right. Do you need it? If we're just talking about the hemostat versus hemostat and TXA, it's about a difference of 130 cc's. So is the added cost of the TXA, TXA is not really that expensive, right? At the end of the day.
It's not.
Is the added cost justified for 130 cc's?
Exactly. And like, there's no transfusion, like it's not a transfusion rate thing, right? Because that's where the money is, right? If you have transfusion or transfusion reactions, that's the problem. But the actual just number of blood loss it's harder to say that how important that is or not.
So, I mean, as far as like the RCT aspect and everything, I don't, you know, the study was well done. I think there's some, when you start to drill deeper below the surface, there are some things here that I think is a cause for pause at the end of the day. Don't have a problem with the ultimate message. I just, clinical impact, I guess, is probably my...
Right. What does 100 cc do for you, you know? And how much 200? Now, if you say it's a liter difference, then we're talking about some big real numbers here, right? But yeah. You're not talking about transfusion. You're not talking about changing the clinical care, you know? We have very low transfusion thresholds now, so I think it's very different.
Anything else from your end on that front?
No, I'm with you.
All right.
Things where more is supposedly better, but at what cost?
We're getting into the honorable mentions. Hang on, everyone, so you can hear about what else there is in the best and brightest in JBJS. This issue, we have involvement of oxidative stress and glycation stress in frozen shoulder. This is a study involving 38 participants, 35 to 70 years old, 16 with frozen shoulder and 22 with a rotator cuff tear without range of motion limitations. In the frozen shoulder group, oxidative stress was indicated by elevated DHE fluorescence and protein carbonyl levels in tissue samples from both the rotator interval and the middle glenohumeral ligament. They found that the frozen shoulder group showed increased expression of glycation stress genes and NOX, along with decreased SOD expression and activity, which they felt was indicative of oxidative stress. Oxidative stress, in addition to glycation stress, should be involved or could be involved in the pathogenesis of frozen shoulder, according to that report by Surakami and colleagues. Then we have effective communication strategies to address excessive waste and overconsumption in the orthopedic operating room by Belair and Frayling, with a comment. So this has like some clinical scenarios. It's Dr. A's first case of the day. That's you that they're talking about, I think, except it's a type 3 supraconductor humeral fracture. So you must have been on call. And she says, I'm planning to pin the elbow without an open incision. Should be a small and straightforward case. I like hearing that they say. So I'm just going to read this because I think it's entertaining. So she finds herself standing among trash bags filled with discarded plastic drapes, unused basins and suction tubing, unused Bovee, plastic holder, stacks of clean disposable towels, endless supply of barely touched egg crate foam pads. She and her team are piling each of these items into waiting trash bags destined for landfill. Much of this waste could have been avoided if there were better systems to communicate the anticipated needs for a surgery. She tries to push aside the nagging thought that inaction on this issue violates her commitment to responsibly manage healthcare resources. As she stands among the trash, she cannot help but feel complicit in this large-scale wrongdoing to our natural environment, patients, and ourselves. It's like a choose-your-own-adventure. Remember those books?
Oh, I love those books, but I didn't feel so bad after reading them.
Yeah, the clinical pretty bad scenarios right now. Is definitely depressing. Yeah, so check out what their recommendations are in terms of, you know, better practices to communicate. It sounded like she tried to communicate, though, in her defense. But next, we have fourth-generation percutaneous transverse osteotomies for hallux valgus by Lam and colleagues, permanently free. This is a study that's a level 4 therapeutic study looking at 729 feet. 483 patients who underwent fourth-generation metatarsal extracapular transverse osteotomy. They maintain this is the largest consecutive series of any percutaneous osteotomy technique used to correct hallux valgus deformity and demonstrate significant improvement in clinical and radiographic outcomes with a low rate of recurrence. Basically, just a very large rote clinical retrospective of these authors' experience with this technique. But obviously, there is definitely some real power there in terms of the total numbers of patients. That rounds it out for this episode. We're kind of running out of time at this point. We'll try to do better next time. If you like what you heard, come back in 2 weeks where we'll be on episode 92. If you didn't, thanks for sticking with us this long. And stay tuned as we continue to move towards episode 100. We can only work with the substrate that we're given in terms of the articles in every issue.